the studios of Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP, in Santa Cruz, California, I'm Gary Shapiro, and this is From the Bookshelf. Dennis Kitchen is my guest this week. He's the founder of Kitchen Sink Press, and he's a fine artist and writer, and he's responsible for bringing some of the great comics and comic book art to us. His latest book, edited with Paul Buell, is a beautiful collection of the work of Harvey Kurtzman, The Art of Harvey Kurtzman, The Mad Genius of Comics. Dennis Kitchen, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Thank you.
Now, Harvey Kurtzman wrote and illustrated comic books, but you credit him with founding an entire generation's sense of humor in a way.
Yes, I think so. I speak as someone who was growing up in the 1950s and in a generally, what can we say, stultifying decade. Mad was a beacon of honest cynicism and satire. We may not have known what it was, the younger readers, but it was clearly revolutionary. He was pointing out the foibles in society and even television and advertising and other comic books that really rung true, I think, to a generation that had otherwise been expected to listen and not question.
So he was sort of the founder of the whole counterculture movement, are you saying?
Some would go that far, yes. And again, it's hard to have complete objectivity because I was part of that movement too. But
right.
People like Art Spiegelman and Robert Crumb certainly have been very outspoken about that. And I think there's a legitimate case to be made.
When you guys were putting together the early days of alternative press, underground comics as we called them, did you talk about Harvey Kurtzman?
Absolutely. I think to every single person involved in underground comics held Harvey in very high regard. Not to overemphasize it, I mean, he was virtually worshipped as somebody who just did something so remarkable. When we go back and we look at those early Mads, they're astonishing, and the amount of labor and talent that went into these, and not just Harvey, but his collaborators, the Wally Woods and Will Elders and Jack Davis, these guys, they were all geniuses, and they came together at this moment in time and produced comics, the likes of which really we've never seen since. They were truly revolutionary, and you have to remember also that comics in those days were very widely circulated in numbers that would astonish, the comics market today.
Yeah, how many copies a month of Mad magazine, or before, when it was a comic book?
When Harvey was doing it, they were in the 600,000 to 800,000 range, and actually after he left, ironically enough, under the Al Feldstein era, when it aimed at a younger audience, it actually peaked around 2 million copies a month.
Wow.
Which are numbers any publisher would die for today.
Well, I want to hear the whole story of Mad magazine, but tell us a little bit about Harvey Kurtzman before Mad, how did he get into comics?
Well, he certainly at an early age had an interest in comics. He actually won a dollar in a contest when he was in his early teens, and I think he once said that was the most important dollar he ever earned. But basically, he got into the business right out of school. He went to the high school in New York that specialized in kids who were into art and music, kind of the school where the movie Fame was made, something very similar to that, where exceptional creative students were segregated. And in that school, some of the people who ended up being his collaborators came out of the same class or a class or two away from him, people like Will Elder and Al Feldstein and Harry Chester, and I think there were half a dozen or so that remarkably came out of that same class. And he got odd jobs early on in comics, working for an obscure packager of comics, but he certainly had made no mark World War II called him, and he, like a lot of guys of that generation, he put his time in. And when he got out, it was a different world in comics, and the so-called packagers, like Will Eisner, for example, was a packager who put books together for publishers. He wasn't a publisher himself. And Harvey worked for a small-time packager today, too obscure to even mention. So he couldn't go back into the system that he had been in before the war, and he had to freelance, and he had to literally go knock on doors. And the door he knocked on that was most receptive was an early incarnation of what we now know as Marvel Comics. And the teenager he worked for was Stan Lee, who's still going strong in his late 80s. And Harvey began producing for them what are known as fillers. And for those not in the industry or too young to know that term, a filler is something a magazine uses when it has some space left, an odd space where they don't have editorial matter or advertising to fill that hole, and typically it's a single page or half page. So they have to have, at least in those days, a drawer of filler material they could just drop in, and it was the lowest of the low. And keep in mind that comic books in the 40s were about the lowest you could get in publishing in terms of lack of respect and lack of money and lack of everything. This was the cheapest form of entertainment, and it was held in very low regard. And so to be a filler artist at the least respected form of entertainment in the world, that was pretty low.
The bottom of the bottom of
it. It was the bottom of the bottom. And yet, what Harvey brought to this is very similar to, I would say, the same spirit that drove Will Eisner. Was somebody in that era who actually believed they were working in an art form, and the craftsmanship that they put into their pages had nothing to do with what they were paid or how much time it took to do it. They were driven by a desire to do great comics. They thought comics were great at a time when they were largely derided and regarded as entertainment for kids. And what happened was he began creating this feature called Hey Look. And the good news about being the bottom of the bottom is that neither Stan Lee nor anyone else at Marvel really cared about it, because it was filler. And normally, this was work for hire. So if you were doing Captain America for them or, something important, you had to sign away all the rights and so on. No one paid any attention to this. And so technically, Harvey kept his copyright because nobody cared. And also, nobody told him what to do, because it didn't matter. It was just fill the page. We don't care. If somebody laughs, fine. If they flip the page, we don't care. Here's your $30. Just make sure it's here on Friday. And
so he retained the rights to all of the Hey Look.
Yeah, it was not something that was negotiated. It was just something done out of neglect. Hmm. But it turned out to be fortuitous, but was not planned.
And this was in the late 40s, and he was...
Well, actually, yeah, we're talking about 1946, basically, when he started doing these. He had worked for Marvel a little earlier, doing other now obscure and forgotten strips. But Hey Look is memorable because he ended up doing them for about 5 years. He did around 150 of them, and it became a body of work where you can literally see Harvey's growth as an artist from the beginning to the end. There's a very distinct difference in style and sensibility, and you can see him refining his sense of humor and his timing and everything. It was a great, basically, an education for him. And he wasn't paid a lot, but he was able to, take care of his most basic needs, and he did other freelance jobs as well. But Hey Look was, I dare say, a unique opportunity for a cartoonist to develop without someone constantly looking over your shoulder and correcting it, making changes, telling you it's not funny. he was able to do some very experimental humor, a lot of visual gags, a lot of things that were pretty sophisticated for its day, and something, a kid wouldn't necessarily completely appreciate. He was drawing more for a peer audience than the perceived audience.
So it was kind of the beginning of the two, you know, operating on two levels. Then
you could argue that, yes. I mean, I think because he consciously was. He knew he had entertained these, kids, but at the same time, he was trying to make the peers in his studio laugh, and that was more important. And I think everyone understood, you know, there were some adults reading comics. Generally, they were considered to be dopes. I can remember, you know, on the rare occasion in the old movies from the 40s and 50s where you'd ever see a comic book, it was usually the dumbest guy in the room reading it.
Hans Hall or somebody.
Yeah, exactly. Someone like him, or I can remember some obscure film noir movie where a gangster asks, you know, the big dumb guy to guard somebody in a room. So the lunk is standing there, and what does he do? He pulls out a comic book, and that got a cheap laugh from the audience because he was regarded as basically as smart as a kid, you know.
Right, right.
So in that environment, somebody like Harvey trying to do something really creative was, let's just say, going against...
Well, now, there was a comic book company we all know and love, which was called EC, and it was... EC originally stood for Educational Comics, and then when the company was passed on to the son, Bill Gaines, he changed it to Entertaining Comics, and rather than restart new comics, he renamed them for
the
same numbering, right?
Well, actually, to save money with the post office.
Right, so instead of having... So it was like... Tales, picture stories from the Bible, number 12, and Tales from the Crypt, number 13, or something like that.
Exactly. A little confusing to readers who were actually trying to keep them in order, but eventually it was sorted out.
And along comes EC. How did Kurtzman get involved with them?
Well, in the late 40s, he finally, you know, what happened at Marvel Comics was Stan Lee finally started giving... Harvey more work, in part because Harvey's eventual wife stuffed the ballot box on a popularity contest. And it backfired in the sense that Stan said, look, instead of doing these fillers, we want you to do a thing called Rusty. And Rusty was a bald-faced ripoff of Blondie and Dagwood. And Harvey hated it. He just hated it. And as much as he tried to emulate the style of Chick Young, the Blondie cartoonist, and to emulate the family humor, it wasn't enough to please Stan or his boss, Martin Goodman. And so after about 50 pages, they basically pulled the plug, and Harvey was encouraged to go elsewhere. He had really been spoiled by the fact that they weren't overlooking his Hey Look strips, and suddenly he realized the irony of getting more popular and getting more work was they were going to pay more attention to it, and that freedom was gone. So as he went knocking on new doors, he went to an outfit he thought was Educational Comics, because he had wanted to do Educational Comics, and instead, as you say, it was a company in transition. And they were getting away from Educational Comics and really doing horror comics, science fiction, genres that didn't necessarily appeal to Harvey, but the samples he pulled out were Hey Look, and Bill Gaines, the owner of EC, had not been familiar with them, and according to both of them, reminiscing years later, Bill sat there for a good half hour just laughing out loud at these things and basically saying, we gotta give you some work.
But one of the comics that by the way, everybody, if you're just joining us, we're talking to Dennis Kitchen, and he's the editor of a wonderful new book called The Art of Harvey Kurtzman, The Mad Genius of Comics. Well, one of the comics that Kurtzman did at EC, one of our favorites, I know it's mine, it was Two-Fisted Tales, which was a war comic, but it was not like any other war comic before or since.
That's right. Harvey, who, you know, had been in the Army, but a lot of guys have been in the Army, but what he brought to War Comics was a different sensibility. He basically broke the mold of War Comics, which had been that these were ultra-patriotic devices. They were very two-dimensional, not that comics are anything but two-dimensional, but the characterizations of both the American soldiers and the enemy were very cliched. And basically it was good guys versus the bad guys, and only small details changed. And Harvey basically saw these comics as an opportunity to show war as it really was, the war is hell theme, which was certainly not unique, but it was unique in comic books. And so young kids who read other brands of comics during this period, when basically the Korean War was raging, they would see the Koreans depicted with a very bright yellow ink for their skin, big buck teeth, and routinely called gooks, and routinely being bayoneted or killed in any variety of grotesque methods with flamethrowers or whatever, and always the Americans won. And if you saw an American hurt, it was through some kind of betrayal or whatever, not because he wasn't brave enough or whatever. It was extremely cliched and uber-patriotic. Harvey showed the humanity of both sides. He dared to show that the Koreans were humans with emotions and families and feelings. And he didn't say, you know, the North Koreans are good guys. He just said, look, they're suffering too. And war is, you know, the definition of inhumanity to man. And instead of glorifying it, he basically showed it as it was. And the stories tended to be very somber, and they tended to be morality tales, and they sometimes had very unhappy endings.
I remember one where a guy has an appendix attack, and the medic is on a remote phone, and he's getting the, you know, the surgeon is telling him step by step how to take the guy's appendix out, and just as the operation is over, it's a success, a bomb falls and kills them all.
Yes. Yes.
But the artwork also of Kurtzman's on these books was very unique, and it seems to me maybe influenced by Asian art. Is that the case?
I'm not sure. I don't remember him ever saying that specifically, but the term that's used a lot for it is it's very expressionistic, a simpler kind of style, and a very bold style. Harvey used a kind of a chiaroscuro effect that maybe was more influenced by Milton Caniff when he was doing Terry and the Pirates or Steve Canyon.
Right.
Very bold black lines. Harvey was a master of the sable brush.
And then did he pencil his work first?
Yes, uh-huh. Yes. In fact, as readers of the book will see, he probably did more preparation for his own work and collaborators than anybody who's ever worked in comics. He was quite fanatical in terms of getting the details right, doing the research. If there was a uniform, he made sure every button, every epaulette was correct. And then he basically dictated the compositions, which sounds perhaps overly controlling or egotistical, but in this case, he had astonishing sense of composition. I don't think there's anybody better ever at composing panels than Harvey. And so his collaborators, whether grudgingly or gladly, followed his layouts. Their own distinctive inking technique, of course, was in the finished page, but the entire theory of the storytelling and the both the layout and typically the text came from Harvey. And sometimes this meant butting heads, and other times he was working with artists who completely respected him. But again, this was unusual. You have to remember at the time, this isn't like Maxwell Perkins kind of editing. This is comic books. And it was considered highly unusual and eccentric for someone to be so emphatic about how a comic book should look or be designed. But again, now looking back, Harvey was way ahead of the curve, and you can count on, you know, one hand and have fingers left how many people were doing truly innovative work in comic books. today, a lot of you younger readers who are familiar with graphic novels and more indie comics might take for granted the fact that comics are an accepted form of expression. But if you go back, in this case, 50 years or so, wasn't the case at all. So the people who were doing really strong work and work with meaningful content were in a distinct minority. And mostly publishers were just cranking out these 10-cent pamphlets and selling hundreds of thousands or millions of them to make a quick buck. And very few people at any level of the industry took it very seriously.
Well, so Kurtzman, obviously an exception there. And Mad Magazine, we're talking with Dennis Kitchen, and he's the editor of The Art of Harvey Kurtzman, the mad genius of comics. Mad Magazine began its life as an EC comic, and Kurtzman was the brains behind that originally?
Yes, and although he obviously had shown in the 40s, with Hey Look in particular, that he had a great sense of humor, it really... Mad developed because he couldn't make an adequate living doing these war comics because Bill Gaines, the publisher, paid on a piecework basis. In other words, Harvey wasn't an employee who was paid, you know, X number of dollars a week to do whatever he could do. He was paid based on the number of pages or books he produced, typically $500 a book. So if it took him a month to do that book, he was paid $500. If he could do one in a week, again, it would be the same. And so because he was spending so much time at the New York Public Library doing research and trying to get the facts right and being so fanatical about his layouts, he could not keep pace with Bill Gaines, for example, who was the competing editor who was able to turn out some multiple of Harvey's and have a comfortable living. And Harvey, who was by this point married and had a growing family, was at his wit's ends. And finally, he and Bill Gaines realized he had to produce something that didn't require that kind of research. And humor became the answer because it didn't require, I shouldn't say any, but certainly not much time at the library.
Since he could make it up.
Yeah, and again, today, you know, he didn't have the benefit of Google, right? He had to go and literally pull books off the shelf and copy it because they also didn't have Xerox machines. I mean, we're talking, you know, prehistoric days, kids.
Well, Mad Magazine originally was sort of a satire on other comic books.
Yes, and that was also a real eye-opener, not just to kids, but I think the growing number of adults who were secretly reading Mad. It became one of those probably guilty pleasures. And the reason we know that is today a lot of people who were adults at the time have, you know, expressed how much it meant to them. But one of the most prominent now, but at the time, a relative unknown himself was Hugh Hefner, who was picking up those Mad comic books in Chicago and was a big admirer. And he ended up making Harvey's acquaintance and ultimately having a big impact on his career. So there were certainly, among Mad's readers, a significant component of what I'd call young intellectuals.
And there was also, I mean, there's a lot of Jewish humor in Mad Magazine, and I guess most of the creators were Jewish.
It sort of
popularized Jewish humor in America for years.
Absolutely. And again, Harvey was not overtly doing anything Jewish. It was just being, I think, a New Yorker and having a sense that a lot of the what would now appear to be Yiddish-inspired terms were just inherently funny. And I think the only exception on the staff was Jack Davis, who was a good old boy from Georgia. But everyone else was a New York Jew, and they brought their own sensibility to the humor, in particular Will Elder, who put in what he called the chicken fat, the eye pops, a lot of the details in the background that were not part of the primary story, but the things you'd notice, especially on rereading, and that was another nice thing about Mad, was you didn't just read it and toss it. You tended to reread it because you'd keep catching things in the background that were also funny.
Right. They filled the page with jokes.
Exactly. You got your money's worth.
Your 10 cents worth.
Yep.
And listeners of this program know the story of Frederick Wertheim and his book Seduction of the Innocent, and how the censorship of comics kind of forced EC out of the field, and Mad became its only surviving publication as a magazine, thus avoiding the comic book censorship. What happened to Harvey Kurtzman when Mad became a magazine?
Well, actually, it's his idea. He insisted on it becoming a magazine because Hugh Hefner, his big admirer, basically said, if you ever want to lose, leave that two-bit operation and work for me, he said, I'll give you what you want, which is a magazine format and color. And so Harvey basically confronted Bill Gaines and said, if you want to escape the comic code censorship, you've got to go to a newsstand magazine because it won't be affected by those publishing guidelines. And also, he said, you can increase the price of the cover from 10 cents to 25 cents, and I think it'll be the salvation of the company. And he convinced Bill, and then he had to convince Bill's mother, who actually controlled the purse strings. And so the family basically funded the magazine, and it was an instant success. In fact, the first magazine was actually reprinted, which is basically unheard of in publishing. If publishers sell out, they're happy to. It's rare, but it's virtually unheard of that you would actually go back to press, because magazines are very transient things, and you just figure, well, we'll sell more the next issue. But after a few issues, it was clear that even getting the magazine that he desired in the larger format, and what he called a slicker format, for Harvey, slick was a positive term, and it meant getting away from that pulp, cheap kid stuff and appealing more overtly to older intellectual readers, because his satire was smart, and he realized that, most 11-year-olds weren't going to get it. And so basically, after just a few issues, four or five issues, he was being increasingly wooed by Hugh Hefner. And Hefner was a very seductive figure. You have to understand, in the 50s, Playboy was itself a revolutionary publication, and Hefner, to a post-war generation of males, was a sexual pioneer in a way that might be harder to understand today. And Harvey thought it would be really cool and really great to work with Hugh Hefner, whereas to him, Bill Gaines was just a schlumpf, an overweight nerd who didn't really get what Harvey was doing and was arguing over pennies, literally, when basically Hugh Hefner offered a blank check. And so Harvey did something that could be regarded in hindsight as the biggest mistake of his career on a number of levels, but he basically demanded 51% of Mad, and Bill Gaines, who was a very paternalistic publisher, who of course had inherited the business from his father and wasn't about to give away a majority of his last vestige, basically said, absolutely not. Now, he was willing to compromise with Harvey. He's even said in interviews before he died that he would have been willing to give Harvey 49% of Mad, but he wasn't going to give him control. And Harvey basically gave Gaines an ultimatum. He knew wouldn't be met, but it was the only condition in which he would stay. So he walked away and he went to work for Hefner, and they launched a magazine called Trump, which most of your viewers, unless they're really serious comic fans, have never heard of, because it only lasted two issues, 1957. And failed not because it was a bad magazine, it was a wonderful magazine, but because Hugh Hefner, in a rare fiscal crisis, had to basically kill the magazine. And it was a very expensive production, but in retrospect, you know, I would like to think that had it continued, it would have been successful, but not in probably the same scale as Mad. And Mad, without Kurtzman, not only continued to flourish, but it actually expanded. And just a few years after Harvey walked away, Bill Gaines sold it for a reported $5 million in 1961 dollars. So had Harvey gotten some portion of that, I mean...
He would have been set for life.
Absolutely.
As it was, he labored for the rest of his life.
Never made much money, never. Even though some people point out that when he was doing Little Annie Fanny later for Hefner, for actually the last quarter century of his life,
yeah,
he and Will Elder got the highest page rate any cartoonist ever got, approaching, you know, into four figures per page. But what people don't always realize either is how long it took to do each one of those pages, and it would often take them a month to do a page.
Well, they were very detailed and well-painted and all
absolutely.
That.
Absolutely. Each panel was a miniature painting, painstakingly constructed. And so it was not a lucrative period, though there are always advantages of working for Hef, and there were certainly some perks, and he got to see the world because Hef would send him wherever he needed to go to research his story, and he was always a welcome visitor at the mansion. Harvey never made real money in his life, and had he stayed at Mad, who knows? We can only speculate.
Well, the book, and it's a beautiful book, it's really beautiful, fantastic artwork, and pencil drawings, and beautiful reproductions, and a lot of laughs. It's called The Art of Harvey Kurtzman, The Mad Genius of Comics. And Dennis Kitchen is the editor. Thank you for spending some time with us on From the Bookshelf.
My pleasure. Thank you.
That's all the time we have for this week's edition of From the Bookshelf, but I'll be back again next week with another great program. In the meantime, check out our podcast page at KUSP.org or find us on Facebook and iTunes. I want to thank our From the Bookshelf staff, Miss Breanne Beal, for all of her hard work. Thanks, Breanne. For From the Bookshelf, I'm Gary Shapiro. See you next time.